Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, CMPD Chief Johnny Jennings releases details of the settlement he reached with City Council, the amount, and the fact that he will retire at the end of January. Parents want more transparency from CMS after they discover the principal at Ardrey Kell High School was suspended with pay. She has now resigned, and another instance of the same thing has surfaced at a middle school. The Trump administration sues the state over voter registration records. City Council's Tijuana Brown, recently indicted by the Department of Justice for wire fraud, meets her constituents, and the CIAA tournament decides not to come home to Charlotte. Here to talk about those stories and more is WFAE News senior editor Eli Portillo. He's here along with WFAE's race and equity reporter Julian Berger. Hunter Sines is a reporter for WSOC-TV, and Nick Oxner is chief investigative reporter for WBTV. Good morning, everybody. Thank
you for being
here. Good morning.
So we've spoken ad nauseum about, and we detailed it in great depth yesterday on our program, but Charlotte City Council reached a behind-the-scenes or behind-the-doors settlement with CMPD Chief Johnny Jennings over texts he was sent by former Charlotte City Councilman Tariq Bakari, which threatened the chief's job. At first, the details of that settlement were hidden from view, and now, thanks to the chief, we know many of the details, including the amount of the settlement. It was $305,000. What else, Eli, do we know?
Well, we know that there is a portion of it that is broken up into a lump sum payment, kind of just cash, $175,000. And the rest is reimbursement for legal expenses, additional vacation days, 40 of them that can be cashed out upon retirement, and a retention bonus to keep working through the end of the year. We know that some of this will not, the one-time stuff won't count towards calculating his pension, but we also have learned that some of these payments will go towards calculating his pension. So in addition to the one-time payout settlement, he will also receive, based on the state employment pension calculations, around at least $9,000 more a year for his pension in perpetuity. So that's kind of a little bit more sweetener on top of what's already, I'd say, a pretty sweet deal.
You talk a lot about transparency, Nick, in city government, and the city was playing this very close to the vest for the longest time. We've had the mayor on the program. She would not reveal the amount of the settlement because of personnel reasons, which we can talk about. But we now know it all because of the chief. He released this information on his own. Why?
He released it to Mike Graff and his new newsletter outlet, Journalism Project, the Charlotte Optimist, on Sunday. And he talked to Mike, did an interview according to Mike, and then signed a release allowing the city to release all this information. The chief's taken a lot of criticism for lots of parts of this, but good on him for taking the steps to make it public. Arguably, he did it on his terms. And we can get into it, but the city's reasoning for not being able to release the amount of the settlement is legally wrong. Happy to talk about why.
Talk about why?
Great. I didn't want to preempt a future question here.
Have it.
The personal information is explicitly not public except for 12 very specific things under the law that are public. The discussion about this settlement in closed session, the city attorney and the city officials are right, should not have been made public. But settlements are explicitly public record under the law. So when you reach a settlement agreement like this, as soon as it was executed, now it may have been that it hadn't been executed until the chief signed it, and then that would have been made public. But this continued contention that we can't tell you the dollar amount because it's a personnel information is wrong. It was a settlement, and I've been fighting with the city of Charlotte to follow the law on this particular point for nearly a decade.
Eli.
And just to kind of hammer that home, if you read this agreement, which is posted online, it says, the settlement terms are, it's pretty explicit. And I just think it's worth underlining that the city's contention in all this is that they could pay a city employee more than that employee's salary as a going away present, so to speak. Obviously, there are legal term, there are legal claims the chief had, so it's to settle those. But it's a retirement, you know, deal. And their contention is they could pay that and never have to tell anyone about it. And never,
compensation
ever.
Is also a public record. The terms of an employee's compensation is also explicitly public record. And that's one of the 12 types of personal information. So any way you square this, they had to be transparent, and they could have been and should have been transparent before the chief signed his personnel information release.
So they're cobbling together this $305,000 from a lot of different buckets, and it includes a $175,000 lump sum payment plus additional cash for a, quote, retention bonus. But the chief revealed, Hunter, that he is retiring at the end of January. So why pay somebody who's retiring in less than a year a retention bonus?
I think it's to keep him on through all of this, quite honestly. I think in a way Chief Jennings is taking the high road in all of this by staying on through the rest of the year instead of like normal people would give a 2 weeks notice. It's a bit more difficult and challenging to find a leader of a police department like CMPD or like any other big city. They are doing a nationwide search. As we know, it will be interesting to see if they pull somebody up the ranks like Jennings was pulled up himself. But to answer your question, I really just think it will get him to stay here through the end of the year because it's a nice, pretty penny that they are keeping him through. But I do think he is he's trying to take the high road. I think you could see that even through the article that broke the news of his soon to be retirement.
So, Nick, they're paying him a retention bonus and he's retiring at the end of January. They're also paying him a certain amount of money that was described as severance. You don't pay severance to somebody who leaves on their own. You pay severance to people you are parting ways with because you don't want them there anymore. Why are we doing this?
That would require anyone in city government who voted to approve this or who negotiated this to provide some explanation, which I still think we're waiting on. And you know, this is just the latest in a long string of incidents in the city where, you know, citizens are entitled to much more information than they're getting. And unfortunately, it's pattern and practice of local leaders to not provide that information.
And Nick, correct me if I'm wrong, because you know more on this than I do, but I would think that they were trying to partly hide some of this into a severance package rather than a settlement of a soon-to-be lawsuit filed against them. Perhaps that is why they were trying to argue to not release any of this from the get-go.
It would still either be compensation or a settlement, so they would still have to make it public. I mean, it's just, what are we hiding here? What are we hiding? That's the question.
So I think it was Eli who said he's getting a settlement in excess of his salary. His salary is $280,000 a year. The nearly $46,000 retention bonus will have additional amounts attached to it because it's going to be added to his pension over the length of his pension, which is life, and it amounts to a 20% salary increase. Again, this is a settlement for a lawsuit that was never filed. So does that mean there is more to this than meets the eye, or are we reading too much into this?
Well, you know, it's kind of common to preemptively settle things if someone says they're going to sue. I mean, that's not like unheard of. I think the part that is more egregious to me as a journalist and someone who's been reporting on the city for a long time is, like Nick and Hunter were saying, the trying to hide it, trying to say that this is not connected to anything that's a public record, even though it pretty clearly is, saying it's not a settlement, but then you read the agreement and it says settlement agreement. I think that to me is more concerning than just, you know, settling a legal claim out of court. That happens.
Hunter.
Mike, I don't want to toot our own horn by any means here, but I do think it is important for your listeners to understand, and perhaps some of them have already reached this conclusion, but I would argue, had it not been for local journalism, we may still not ever know about this. We may not have known it by the time he actually retires in January.
That's true. And we should credit Steve Harrison at WFAE and Joe Bruno at WSOC for, you know, really over months hammering away at this and bringing it to light. It's been a long road. And I think that to Nick's earlier point, the pattern in practice here, if you look back at the city at the end of last year, getting rid of the former city attorney and not providing an explanation, not providing his payout, it's become a pattern for Charlotte. Yes.
Dave Bolick, who is the state auditor, is announced last week, I think it was last week, things go by so quickly now, who can remember, that he's launching a statewide investigation into this because there is no tax dollar, he said, that should be free from public scrutiny. And this week he added that he was glad the details of this were released. But does this mean his investigation is over, or Nick, will he pursue it?
The fun part about being auditor is you can look into whatever you want. If I could wave my wand and not have to run for an office but get to hold one, it would be state auditor, because you can just do exactly what Dave Bullock's doing here and look into something. So my guess is he'll still look into it. I think we've just spent the last 12 minutes outlining additional questions we have around this. And so someone with subpoena power and a whole staff that can dig into things ought to be looking into it. So cheers to the auditor for doing that. Hopefully this isn't a one-off.
Reaction by some on council to this settlement and how it was handled through these closed door sessions, because there were two closed door meetings, has rankled some of the members. And we heard charges recently of unethical, even illegal behavior leveled by at least one member of council about these recent actions. And that has raised questions of trust among members of that body. And some have raised concerns over the leaks of what happened behind the scenes to the media, which, as one of you pointed out a second ago, if that hadn't happened, we'd still be in the dark. LaWanna Mayfield brought that up at this week's council meeting.
There has to be a level of accountability when we are having very sensitive conversations and that information is then being reported to the media, either verbatim or in some cases incorrectly, and we do not know that which one of the members is providing this information.
She then asked the interim city attorney, Anthony Fox, what it would take to learn the source of the leaks. What would it take?
Well, Anthony Fox told her that it would take a direction from council to do that, the six votes, and that he would not be able to do that based on one council member's request. They would have to actually vote on it. It didn't appear at Monday's meeting that they had the votes for that, so they didn't.
And Mayfield noted that council members cannot censure each other, but there needed to be a level of accountability. And she asked this question.
Can there be language to say no cell phones, no smartphones, no nothing in our closed session, so that we can have a meeting that doesn't be reported to the media immediately afterwards? Because there are a lot of important discussions that we have.
And she added she'd like to see council work on closed session guidelines. But Mayor Lyles urged members not to be hasty. Why?
Well, she basically said, hey, let's think about this. Let's put this off a little bit. I think council has already been through a lot in the last few months, a lot of different going back and forth. They had that whole press conference trying to rebut one council member who said that she had seen immoral and illegal activity after the settlement came out. Now you have an indicted council member starting a leak investigation and calling in the plumbers right now. Might be just one more thing that's too much.
And Mayor Lyle said the council may discuss this again behind closed doors. Oh, the optics. When we come back, we'll talk about that indicted council member. We'll talk about a new member of council and more. Stay with us. It's the local news roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup, hence the presence of several reporters. Eli Portillo, our senior editor at WFAE News. Julian Berger is with us, our race and equity reporter. Hunter Sines is a reporter for WSOC-TV. And across the aisle and up on Fulfillment Hill, Nick Oxner, chief investigative reporter at WBTV. I can only say that because I used to work there. Okay, last week, the Department of Justice, in a case under investigation initially during the Biden administration, handed down an indictment against City Council member Tijuana Brown and her daughters, alleging wire fraud and conspiracy to commit wire fraud because of an application they made for COVID-19 PPP relief money. That money was earmarked for business owners to provide payroll money for their employees during the shutdown. She was using it allegedly to start a new business, which doesn't exactly fit the guidelines, but there was more to it than that. Interestingly, she held a town hall meeting on Wednesday night, Hunter, that was scheduled before the indictment, and this topic was not even brought up by people there. Why?
So people there focused on issues they say that they were facing in their district. Glenn Counts, our reporter, went and talked to multiple people there. Why didn't they bring it up? They said, we're letting the courts decide this. I don't have an opinion one way or the other. Other people applauded her for even showing up and not canceling when she could have. The only time that we heard anything about it was in her closing remarks.
Yeah, to her credit, she brought this up, saying that it's been a very difficult experience for her.
But I want you to hear directly from me. I am still here, I'm still fighting, and I'm still serving. When I ran for office, I told you that all my life I had to fight. Well, I'm fighting now.
Nick, WBTV reports that statement was followed by applause from the crowd. Does that speak either to her popularity, her effectiveness as a representative for that district, or the fact that many of her constituents are suspicious of the legal system?
I mean, why do we have to choose, Mike? Let's also...
Because I have to ask a question, that's why.
I would say that people dedicated enough to come to their city council members' town hall forum are not a representative sample of certainly the public or even of the voting population. So good for them for being there. Mm-hmm. We don't know really who these folks are. And in some respects, though, good for her for continuing to face questions. Can't believe her defense attorney's letting her do this, although at her first press conference pre-arraignment, we saw him cut her off multiple times. So, you know, still good for her. We just finished talking about how untransparent local officials are, which is still generally true, but good for her for being willing to answer some questions here. That's always the refreshing playbook when people face instances like this.
Yeah. And Mike, I was going to say, I believe you said this at the beginning, a reminder, this allegedly happened before she ever took office. And so I don't know if that has something to do with it, too, on the people who were talked to there, so-and-so constituents, even though, like Nick said, are they constituents? We have no idea. Anybody can show up. But was that a factor that, hey, technically this happened, allegedly happened before she was an elected official. So am I going to hold it against her in this capacity?
And also, before she was an elected official, she served, I think, 4 years in prison for previous infraction of the law. And voters knew that when they said yes to her being on council, which makes her the first formerly incarcerated person ever to serve on that council. Eli?
Yeah, and I was going to say, since, you know, I think the biggest question for a constituent in this situation is, are you going to resign? Are you going to run again? She's already answered those. So I think for the typical constituent, there's not that much more to ask right now about her. Yeah. It's just wait and see what happens with the legal system.
Although, even though it didn't come up from any of the questions and answer session that she held with constituents at that meeting, not everybody was convinced. Steel Creek resident Patrick Burris reacted this way to the allegations against Brown.
As far as Councilwoman Brown, it's a very disturbing allegation that she faces. And you know, her passions for the community, for the district, although impressive, it's a bit disturbing.
And Tijuana Brown has said that when she learned of scrutiny revolving around her PPP application, she paid back the portion of the loan for which she is allegedly responsible, $20,833. And she also says she looks forward to her day in court and that a plea deal is not an option. But I asked this yesterday during the program, so I'll ask it of a new group of reporters. She paid back her portion of the loan for which she is allegedly responsible. I've lost the thread of my question. Go ahead,
Mike.
Go ahead.
I have something to say. You know, a lot of people who I have talked about this with brings up, so if you rob a bank and you bring back the money, does it make it not a crime? Is one argument. The other part of this is when you put it into context of other COVID relief fraud cases, this is a tiny amount of money compared to other cases. So even if she says she's not taking a plea deal, if that actually happens and she takes a plea deal, or if she is later convicted, in the grand scheme of things, I don't believe that she will be sentenced to much time, if any at all. It would more likely be like a probationary period, which I don't know the legalities of if that makes her give up her role as an elected official or not. But just putting it into context on the bigger things.
When we had Russ Ferguson on the program last week, he's the U.S. Attorney for the Western District of North Carolina. He said that the judges in these situations usually look at the amount of the infraction and adjust the sentence accordingly. And also they take into consideration whether or not the person who is being charged, if found guilty, did it because they knowingly did it, or they did it because they were ignorant of the law. So we'll see. Sticking with city council for a moment, District 6 has a new representative on council to fill the seat left open by Tariq Bakari, who has departed to go to Washington with Nick to be part of the we'll talk about that later, to be part of the Trump administration. With the mayor breaking a 5-5 tie, Ed Peacock was anointed, and this week he was sworn in. If you've been here for a while, you know Edwin Peacock III. If you're a newcomer, you don't. So, Eli, who is he?
He is a former Charlotte City Council member, and in 2013, he ran for mayor, lost to Patrick Cannon, who was soon after indicted on bribery charges, to which he pleaded guilty and went to prison for. Edwin Peacock has been out of the council since then and has raised his hand and said that he will serve out Tariq Bakari's term. He's a familiar, known quantity, and I think city council liked that he's someone who can jump in without having to learn the ropes. You know, he's been on council. Many of them know him, and he said he won't run again, which they also like because they don't want to kind of anoint someone an incumbent.
He's already used to the backroom squabbling in closed session, so he can jump right into the fray.
This is the only truly competitive district, District 6, and there is an opening perhaps for a Democrat for the first time in a long time. And since Edwin Peacock, he was the last person to win an at-large seat, last Republican to win an at-large seat on council, is not going to run again. That leaves the field open on both parties. But Krista Bakari was the other half of that 5-5 split vote. Five people voted for him, five people voted for her. The mayor broke the tie in his favor. So Krista Bakari, does she intend to run, Nick?
Sorry, for the people listening, you just watched me try to struggle to unmute myself like it's 2020 and the pandemic. Anyways, I think she certainly intends to. If I had to guess, that was probably the reason why she's not sitting on council now, because I think they were really looking for someone who was not trying to use this as a launching pad for a full campaign.
And do you think a Democrat has a chance in this district in November?
Democrats have continued thinking they have a chance for the last two election cycles. Of course, Tariq Bakari won re-election both times, albeit, you know, not by a super wide margin. It is certainly the most competitive district. You could argue that someone who also has the last name Bakari, which is not, you know, Smith or Johnson, right? It's a recognizable name in Charlotte, both because it's unique and because Tariq is good at making news about himself, could have an advantage in name recognition in that election. So, you know, certainly competitive, but interesting.
Plus, you don't have to reprint the leftover campaign signs.
Bakari for D6, it still works.
That's right. So, in order to tackle a deficit and raise property taxes only minimally, County Manager Dina DiIorio recommended cutting some funding in her budget for nonprofits from that Mecklenburg County budget.
Construction has slowed, and so new growth on the property tax side, I think, is going to be fairly limited over the next few years. We don't know what the impact is going to be for cuts at the federal level and how those trickle down to the state and how those trickle down to the local level.
Nevertheless, yesterday, commissioners voted to restore some of that funding. Who can breathe a sigh of relief, Eli?
Well, I hate to say I called it, but, you know, someone once told me if you don't beat your own chest, who will? So I'll beat my own chest a little bit. Last week when we talked about this, I predicted that they would have difficulty resisting the urge to dip into fund balance to help out some of these nonprofits. And groups like Crisis Assistance Ministry, Community Culinary Kitchen, a lot of these smaller nonprofits that the county typically helps out with, you know, six-figure grants, they have had some of their funding restored as of this straw vote. It's not final yet. They'll vote on the final budget next week. But what they agreed to, more or less, was to give them half their funding. And the reasoning was this is one-time funding, but they need a chance to ramp down rather than suddenly have all their grants cut off. I think it's worth cutting or pointing out that this is not break the bank money. This is
how
not
much, how much is it? How much are we talking
about? I don't have a running total. They were going through them, but each one of these groups, it's, you know, five or six figures per group. So tens of thousands to hundred thousands out of the county's $2.5 billion budget. It's a small amount, but Dina was still trying to say, hey, don't do this. Save your rainy day fund for a rainy day because it might storm.
Yeah. When she was on this program and when she presented her budget to the commission, they knew going into this budget cycle that they were going to have a deficit and they would have to handle that deficit this time around with this slight property tax increase. But now we're talking and she cut nonprofits as part of the of ways to save money. And now we're putting some of that money back in. So is the choice on council now to cut further elsewhere or to raise property taxes slightly more?
No, the choice now is just to approve or not approve dipping into the bank account, basically to pay for this one-time money. They are not talking about raising property taxes more to cover this funding. They are talking about going a little into the reserves, which Dina again said, hey, don't do it. Save that rainy day money. But they said, we need to help these groups out. So this won't affect property taxes, but property taxes are going up because of what's already in the budget.
So, Nick.
Yeah, look, this whole situation is the result of commissioners making choices exactly like what Eli just outlined, where they don't want to raise property taxes anymore because who wants a tax increase and it looks bad to voters, but they also don't want to make the cuts necessary to not raise taxes anymore. We've seen this with the commission for years and years. Of course, the other elephant in the room is the fact that CMS is getting yet another budget increase. The county has to fund the school system. Their hands are kind of tied because of some state laws to that, but a big chunk that's pushing the need for property tax increases again and continuing to balloon the county's budget is the specific piece related to school funding.
So the summer vacation and summer flying seasons are about to start, and airport workers at Charlotte Douglas International want higher wages, so they've started a letter writing campaign. To whom are they sending these letters, Eli?
So they've been pushing Charlotte City Council to look at whether they can pass an ordinance or do something with lease negotiations, since the city owns the airport, to enforce higher wages for contract workers. So this week they dropped hundreds of letters, postcards off at City Council for City Council members. The workers pushing for these higher wages are like cabin cleaners, the people who push folks in wheelchairs. The workers are basically contracted, by subcontractors for the airline. So,
and on these cards, they're telling their story. They're telling the story of workers who are currently homeless, who can't afford groceries, who find it difficult to live paycheck to paycheck. And WFAE spoke with LaShonda Barber. She's an airport worker who says she and her colleagues, what they do is vital to the airport and to the city, and that their compensation needs to reflect that.
We need our bills paid. Like, we can't afford to get on these planes and travel like y'all. But we is very happy to make this plane go up in the air, do whatever it takes to keep a smile on y'all face, because we are the airport. The workers are the airport. We are the community.
A recent survey by the Service Employees International Union found that 40% of our airport's employees cannot afford housing. Some are living in hotels and shelters and in their cars. Will that come as news to people who run this airport, to people who run this city, and to most of the people listening to us right now?
You know, I think that if you look at the wages they say they're being paid, I think the union says they're being paid between $12 and $19 an hour. I mean, $12 an hour, if that's your main source of income, it's really hard to make it on that now. The city's minimum wage is set to, for municipal workers, is set to go up to $24 an hour starting next fiscal year if they approve their budget. So, you know, you'll have some airport workers making half of what the city has said municipal workers should be paid. And that's tough.
Yeah, they aren't just asking for higher wages. So they're asking for other things as well. What are they?
Safer conditions, more training. They say that, you know, some of the work they do is dangerous. Some of these folks are out on the ramp there hauling heavy things, driving vehicles, moving between planes with running jet engines. They say that there's a lot of high turnover because of the low wages, and that that creates unsafe conditions for folks who are out there working around large jets. So they want more training, better conditions, and less turnover as well.
And WFAE spoke with Dominique Chambers, an organizer of this petition effort.
Well, I would like for City Council to step up and see how it is to be in our shoes, what we have to face behind the scenes, such as living in the cars, living with our families, even face homelessness.
So WCNC-TV reports that the workers union also requested the city council to have a hearing on airport safety, what you just talked about, Eli, and the high turnover of employees out there. They requested that. The mayor turned down the request for holding a hearing on this. Why?
Well, you know, American Airlines is a really powerful company here, and I think that the city... they're in lease negotiations, I believe, with American right now for the airport. So I think that the city is going to tread carefully around a hearing that could increase their costs and, you know, talk more about contentious working conditions.
The union called the mayor's decision not to hold a hearing as both irresponsible and telling. When we come back, Charlotte City Council and their decision to kind of buck the Trump administration on climate activities, and ICE once again is being active in Charlotte. We'll talk about that too when we come back. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's the local news roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. We're here with Eli Portillo, senior editor of WFAE News. Julian Berger has been very quiet, but is about not to be. He's our race and equity reporter for WFAE. Hunter Sines is a reporter for WSOC-TV. And Nick Oxner is chief investigative reporter for WBTV. The Trump administration may be taking a match to Biden-era climate and energy goals, but Charlotte is moving ahead with theirs. On Monday, Charlotte City Council voted unanimously to adopt new city climate and energy goals. What are they, Eli, and what impact are they projected to have?
So the city is kind of focusing the next phase of its strategic energy action plan on more community-wide changes. The first phase has been focused on things like putting solar panels on municipal buildings and trying to get EVs for municipal cars instead of gas-burning cars. It's worth noting, I think, that the EV goal has been going really slowly and they haven't gotten there yet. But they're pushing that back. The second phase is supposed to do things like increase connectivity between neighborhoods and give people more options to walk or bike so that it's easier to not have a car and not use a car, adding charging stations for EVs, especially in lower income neighborhoods, to make it easier for people to own non-gas vehicles. And they're trying to focus beyond what the city can do with its own buildings more on how to build the community to be more climate friendly.
It's odd, given Donald Trump's relationship with Elon Musk, which I guess ends today because Elon is leaving his Doge job in the federal government. But since he's the head of Tesla, it's odd that the Trump administration is taking these actions that thwart the progress of electric vehicles, which are much cheaper to operate for consumers, interestingly enough. But while some entities are backing away from electric vehicles, the city plans to reduce the number of light-duty vehicles with EVs by 2035 and their entire fleet by 2050. Usually, municipalities rely on federal help to fund at least a portion of this. Why do they feel confident that they can proceed in this current drill, baby, drill environment?
Well, I think one thing to note from, a cynical pessimist perspective is that 2035 is 10 years away, and it's kind of easy to set a goal that you'll be replacing all of these within 10 years. That's a pretty long time frame. A lot of the municipal fleet vehicles they have will age out over that time, so they'll need to be replaced anyway. I think it would be, you know, much more striking and, frankly, prohibitively difficult if they said we're going to do this within, you know, 3 years.
Right. So ICE remains active here and nationwide. Julian, this week, ICE agents detained as many as 8 people outside Charlotte's immigration court after their pending cases were dismissed. The cases were dismissed. Why were they detained?
Yeah, so a lot of these people that had their cases dismissed, they were asylum seekers, refugees that were going into the immigration court. A lot of them, no criminal record, no legal representation. And what it means when these cases are dismissed is that these people are now considered undocumented. So once they step outside of the court, they're basically automatically eligible to be detained by ICE. So ICE, we've been seeing this nationwide. They're dismissing these cases, and then ICE is outside of the courtroom ready to pick them up to detain them.
So when they are picked up and detained, for how long are they held?
So they're held until they have a court date where the judge is able to determine whether they can be released or whether they're eligible for removal from the country. And we've been seeing that that's been taking about like 4 to 6 weeks for somebody to have a court date and be able to see an immigration judge.
You also report that the family of a man arrested by ICE in East Charlotte this month claims to have lived in the country for around 30 years. He has no criminal record. Who is Jose Martinez, and why was he arrested, and is he still being detained?
Yeah, so Jose Martinez, he's one of the many people that have been detained this month by ICE and what they're calling a larger enforcement operation. So he's lived here for 30 years from Mexico. He was a construction worker. He was detained off of Central Avenue, where a lot of immigrants here in Charlotte live, in East Charlotte. And then from there, he was sent to Georgia, to an ICE jail there. His court date is next week, so we'll see what his status is, whether he's able to stay in the country or whether he is ordered for removal.
The Trump administration claims that they are targeting, picking up, detaining, and deporting undocumented criminals and gang members. But you spoke with his daughter, 22-year-old Joanna Martinez. How did she describe her father?
Yeah, she said he was not a criminal. He was an amazing person. She would always say that he would always love to go out to the Mexican restaurants, have a drink, have a beer. And even though he would only have one beer, he would make her mother be the one to drive because he would never want to get in any trouble with the police or anything like that. And that's what we've been seeing. A lot of these people that have been detained by ICE, they aren't criminals. They don't have any criminal record. It seems like it's been more racial profiling.
You report that he's one of the city's best sheetrockers, and we know that the home building industry, the construction industry, depends a lot on these immigrants for labor. He's one of the best, evidently, by all reports. He's a man who raised 11 children. Four of them were adopted children. And Joanna Martinez told you that her father had always followed the law. She described what the family has been through, however, following his detention.
Since his detention, I have struggled to sleep, tormented by the thought that he was left unfed for days and is suffering while being detained.
And she saw him in detention, and she says that he had been handcuffed in a cell and went without food for 2 days until he arrived at the Stewart Detention Center in Southwest Georgia.
For the first time in my life, I saw my father cry. The man who had always been our rock, our provider, was reduced to tears, and it shattered our hearts.
Julian, can her story be corroborated? I mean, detaining somebody for 2 days, handcuffed in a cell without food, would seem to be, that would constitute cruel and unusual punishment, which I think would make it unconstitutional. I'm not a lawyer, but I think it would. Can we corroborate that?
Yeah, Jose's case is not uncommon. We see this all the time where I've been hearing from Carolina Migrant Network, one of the nonprofits who deals with detainees, people who are detained by ICE. They say the same thing, that a lot of these people that are detained by ICE, they go without food, water for days. They're handcuffed in a cell for days. So this type of treatment is something that we've seen before.
Where was he when he was denied food for 2 days? In Charlotte, in the county jail? Where was he?
Yeah, so he, in that 2 day span, he had gone to the ICE field office, which is located off of Tivola Boulevard. And then they transferred him to Alamance County Jail. And then basically Alamance County is where everybody who is detained by ICE is brought together. And then from Alamance, brought to the ICE jail in Georgia. And that's where.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's where he was finally able to eat in Georgia.
Why don't they feed them?
We're not sure. I don't have the answer to that.
Okay. Meanwhile,
we should point out that Sheriff Terry Johnson, the longtime sheriff in Alamance County, has faced for more than a decade questions and scrutiny around his civil rights track record and his both about migrants and others. So this would be the latest allegations coming out of Sheriff Johnson's treatment of immigrants.
Meanwhile, some faith leaders here have joined others elsewhere in the country. They say that they have a message for ICE, and that is stay away from places of worship. Hunter, you looked into rumors about an arrest outside an East Charlotte church. What did you learn?
Yeah, so faith leaders came together and confirmed that there was nobody detained near the Central United Methodist Church, which is also serves as a preschool, a dual language preschool in East Charlotte. But that ICE did stage outside of that church, and they believe that it was to incite fear among people who are dropping off and picking up their kids.
And even though there may not have been a detention, church leaders say that ICE is setting up staging locations at Central Methodist Church, and they want them to stop. Reverend Jennifer Copeland is executive director of the North Carolina Council of Churches. She says this issue goes beyond politics or personal opinions.
It's not a question of which way's the wind blowing for us politically or socially or personally. It's what is God calling us to do as God's people in this moment?
That was at a recent press conference. In a separate press conference held by the Latin American Coalition to explain to the Latino community the role of law enforcement, Mecklenburg County Sheriff Gary McFadden reiterated what he's been saying all along, that these roundups do not improve public safety. On the contrary.
Our Hispanic and Latino communities are victims of crimes. They are witnesses of crimes, and we want to make sure that they understand that they can report crimes and don't feel helpless.
He also told the group that he does not collaborate with ICE except when a warrant is being fulfilled. What is the level of fear, Julian, in the Latino community now as compared, to a month ago, 5 months ago, this time last year?
Yeah, I think Everybody's just scared going out and about in public. I've been getting so many texts, so many calls from people that, oh, I think I see ICE. I think ICE is near a school. I think ICE is near a church. When in a lot of cases, these rumors that I'm hearing, it's actually CMPD or the sheriff. There's a heightened level of fear, and people aren't sure whether ICE is in their community or not.
Hunter.
One example, Mike, that happened to me this week, I was talking with a friend. He's from Costa Rica, and this was brought up. He knows clearly what I do and had seen the church story that we had done earlier this week. And he said, I mean, I'm scared. I carry my passport around just in case there's a racial profiling of being pulled over, so I can at least show my passport that I am a citizen here, even though I was born in Costa Rica. So that's just a glimpse into what Julian has widely reported on of the fear that has grown over the past few months.
Parents of students at Ardrey Kell High School have been demanding greater transparency of Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools because they found out after the fact that the principal of Ardrey Kell had been suspended with pay. That principal has now resigned. Kelly Ludwig is a parent who spoke with WCNC-TV.
When you remove our principal and you don't tell us for 3 weeks, that is very suspicious.
So that principal is Jamie Brooks. She has now decided to retire. Following that suspension, do we know why she was suspended, Eli?
We don't. The school system has said they can't comment on it because it's a personnel matter. We do know that Ardrey Kell has been, of course, the subject of a lot of high-profile news coverage since an alleged hate crime took place there. The family of a Muslim girl said that she was attacked by a boy for her faith. The boy's family has denied that and filed a counter lawsuit. Obviously, there's been a really bright light on Ardrey Kell since then and a lot of controversy. I think it's worth noting this is the second time in 5 years Ardrey Kell's had a principal resign under kind of unclear circumstances. So that's probably contributing to some of the parents' dismay here.
The Ardrey Kell principal issued a statement when she decided to retire as a result of that, which will be effective, by the way, June 1st. She says she's retiring with her deepest sadness. And Ardrey Kell parents have started the petition asking CMS to improve communications. Have they received any response?
Not to my knowledge.
And meanwhile, WBTV reports that the principal at Randolph Middle School was suspended with pay, just like the Ardrey Kell principal earlier this month. Once again, Nick, do we know why?
No, and it's worth noting here, since we had this discussion about what a personnel record is in the context of the police chief, under the state law, you can know that someone is suspended, but it actually would be illegal for someone to tell you why. So I hate to give some transparency plaudits to CMS, but here we are.
Okay, the Trump administration is suing everyone, it seems, and now they are suing North Carolina over voter registration records. They accuse the state's Board of Elections of violating federal law by failing to ensure voter registration records. Okay, that seems redundant to me, but what is this all about, Nick?
So the Help America's Votes Act, otherwise known as HAVA, requires that state boards of elections collect certain information about voters when they register to vote. A couple years ago, the State Board of Elections acknowledged that, yes, for some voters, they had failed to collect that information, but basically said, we're going to just cure it on an ad hoc basis. And so this lawsuit from the Trump administration seeks to have the state implement a policy and plan to go collect that missing information from select voters more expeditiously.
So how will this impact, if this stands, how will this impact voters or future elections?
Some voters may have to provide some additional information.
So very quickly, Eli, we hosted the CIAA basketball tournament for years. In fact, we are the headquarters of the CIAA, but they're in Baltimore now playing. They've been playing there for several years, and we put in the bid to bring them back. And this week they said, well, they reached the decision. What did they say?
They said, see you later, Charlotte. We're staying in Baltimore. They've been there since 2021, and they will be there through 2029. Charlotte was the only city to put in a bid to try to take it from Baltimore, and they said nope.
Yep. So we'll have to wait until what, 2027, 2030 to put a new pitch in. In terms of hockey, the Charlotte Checkers are still in it. The Eastern Conference Finals for the Calder Club playoffs, they've won two games in a row, so they're still in the running for the finals. And finally, we have to say goodbye to longtime contributor Nick Oxner. Nick Oxner is the chief investigative reporter, at least for the next 20 minutes, at WBTV. Where are you going, Nick?
Moving to D.C. to take a job with the State Department as a Foreign Service officer.
What does that mean?
I'll be a diplomat working at an embassy as a political officer over. So I'm going far, far away.
Do you know where yet?
No, not yet.
Really? You're just taking a job and they can let you send, you're going to let them send you anywhere?
Well, I'll be in D.C. for a while first, and then yes.
And how can you use these investigative skills that you have honed to a fever pitch in that job?
It's a good opportunity to pick up new skills, Mike. I'm not quite yet an old dog, so I'm trying to learn some new tricks.
Well, on behalf of Mayor Lyles and everybody on City Council, I want to thank you for leaving. No, I'm just kidding. I want to thank you for your service, not only to the community and WBTV, but to us on this program. You don't have to do this. You do it out of the goodness of your heart, and we appreciate it. Nick Oxner from WBTV, Hunter Sines from WSOC-TV. The same goes for you, Hunter. Julian Berger and Eli Portillo from WFAE. Thank you for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.